Hey everyone, here is my third episode of Ag Uncensored, my new podcast, reviewing all things ag tech and beyond in agriculture. And as I am your host, Nathan Filighty here, I have an interesting and great guest that I've got to know over the last few years in Godfred Pessel joining me today of Metos by Pessel Instruments. He's the founder and the head honcho of it all. So thanks for being here, Godfred.
Thanks a lot, Nathan, for the invite. And great to be with you in this third edition of your podcast. And I hope you have soon the next 100 editions coming up. And I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, and it's... I think one of the big reasons I wanted you on early on is you have a plethora of history and knowledge around ag, and not just from kind of the perspective of where I've been around and grew up in the North America or US. You've been around the globe and have seen so much of the changes and different cultures around agriculture itself and beyond, and the science of it. And I think there's no telling how long we could probably talk about all that, but we'll try to shove it all in an hour here, or part two down the road or something. Who knows? So jumping in though, I guess tell for the people that don't know who you are or the Pessel side, the Metos side, talk a little bit about your past, your history, who you are, what you're doing, anything you'd like to share about yourself.
Okay. Yeah. Very. I'm happy to do that. Yeah, I am getting 65 this year, so which means normally it's the time to take a rest and and settle down. And my father, by the way, he retired with 60. He's now 90, and he already enjoys retirement since 30 years. So I hope that's a good sign. That's but. I'm coming actually from, I always say that, from a subsistence Austrian farming family. And sure. Which means alpine farming. My mother wanted to have a farm. So my father bought her a farm when they were just married in, let's say, 1961. She was coming from a family, from a farming family, a big farming family in, let's say, relatively big, because at that time 50 hectares, which is about 120 acres, was a big farm in that time, no, in the post-war. And so I grew up on a 10 hectare farm, where about 5 hectares was forest and 5 hectares was let's say meadow, no. And so we had a few cows and that's about it. And it was not a full, let's say, farm for where you can make your living. My father was working in the building industry, and mom had also, let's say, a bed and breakfast, or an Airbnb, would you call it now? No?
Okay. So, before it was cool, yeah.
So we were 5 kids, and I'm the oldest of the 5. And my mom said, and my father said, you have to go also to the agriculture college. So. And at that time, you abate on that things. No, I never was really farm. I didn't like farming because I was more of a slave on the farm of my sure. mom, because you had to do the haying and all the things. So anyway, I went to the school, a farming school, made my, let's say, college there. And but I was not really super interested in the farming. So I went working for a co-op. After school, and then there was the mandatory military at that time, because we are still in the Cold War, and war, because we were close to the border. So it was an interesting time at that time, and we're coming back to this time again. So I will talk a little bit later about history, but anyway, so after the military service, I joined banking, and I was a banker for about 7 years. I made, let's say, it was not enough to be working 5 or 9 to 5 on the bank. So I started business administration MBA. I did an MBA at the University in Graz. And after 7 years, I got really fed up with banking. And my cousin, that dates back because my cousin was a strawberry farmer at that time. He had a big farm with strawberry grown and about 3,000 feet sea level, which is quite high. So you could grow strawberries or harvest strawberries in August when nobody else had strawberries at that time.
Oh.
So he was selling it at a high price. But my aunt, she was an elderly lady as well already. So he invented a strawberry picker.
Oh.
And this was in the, let's say, beginning of the 80s. And I got excited about his patent. And I said, let's start a business together because it's a side business when I was still in the bank.
Sure.
And then we found somebody to produce it. And so we started to go and show it to people. And went to Italy because Italy was at that time a very big strawberry producer and still is there. And we found interest, and I said, okay, maybe I should quit the job in the bank and make my own startup. That was when I was 25. So this year we are completing 40 years of Bessel Instruments. And we were growing a little bit slow with their own money. And of course, at that time, that was in the mid-80s. And then history caught us. We were just building up the product. The strawberry harvest, there was one product. There was another product, which we had a transplanter for strawberry transplants, a small bin transporter for apple trees, apple bins, because the company is Invites, which is just for those interested in the geography of Austria. It's about 100 miles south of Vienna, in the midst of the apple growing area of Austria. Very intensive apple production. Strawberry also is one of the areas here. And at that time, the apple production was booming. The farmers didn't have to worry about money. They just made money like anything. And with the apples.
That's never a bad thing. So
yeah, it's never a bad thing. But of course, the leaf. The coin turned, and now a lot of the apple production in that area is now fading away. They're changing into, let's say, because climate change hit in the meantime, of course, that now the apples, they took out the apples and put in grapes, where in the past the grapes would never make a decent wine. But anyway, long story short, I got involved in weather stations through the school of my cousin, who was in that time a partner, and basically they invented a disease predictor for apples cap, which is the black spot in apples. Which if you have a black spot, if you are an apple grower and you don't spray, 100% sure you get these black spots on your apples. Unless you grow the apples in the desert, no? But most apples are not grown in the desert because.
Yes.
But so, and that changed basically at the end of the day. It changed the direction of Bessel Instruments because we saw that this product has huge potential. And I hired my first engineers, software engineer, and that was basically in the late 80s, 89, 90. And then I started with my cousin, but my cousin then was more involved in the farming business. So, he said, I need to go out there because my business is too big. So, he sold me his shares and then later I had my ex-wife at that time working in the business. By the way, I'm three times grandfather with 10 years old with a 7 years old and the two years old, two girls and one boy. And I have three kids in total. So I have a daughter of 39 and a daughter of 34 and a son of 11. And with my second wife, which my second wife is from Italy. And we spent a bit of time, of course, also in Italy now. But anyway, so that gives you, let's say, a little bit private life as well. I'm a passionate golfer. I'm a passionate runner. I'm a passionate skier. Soccer player. I was, by the way, just for the fun in between, I was watching a football match, a soccer match last Sunday with my son, because my bank gave me some VIP tickets for the trainer bench in the stadium in Austria. And it was a super experience for my son, because he loves soccer. And we won 4-0 against the team. So we are in the playoff now. And we hope that we are going into the Champions League now. So I like sports in general. And for my 50th birthday, I was running the New York Marathon, no, for example.
Oh, geez. Well, all aspirations to go after. And I know when I messaged you, a few weeks ago, and you said, "Well, I'm going skiing in Italy." I just the jealousy arose like crazy, because I also enjoy skiing and golfing, and we seem to have a lot of similarities, even our hair growth. But you've got a few years on me too. So.
Yeah, I got a few years ahead of you.
But well, and even you said your daughter's age, same age, so it's kind of and you're similar age to my dad too, so it's always an interesting talk just with the differences from that perspective. But no, I mean, that I didn't know that early history with the strawberry side. That's really interesting, and I suppose it helped you get quite a bit different perspective, just from, you know, different sides of agriculture, of jumping into that, well, the apple side too. And so, you know, from where did the first kind of, you know, 'cause everyone kind of knows you now as from the weather station side of things. And where did that, like, what year, where did that really get going and kind of expand? Or was it kind of just a really slow little kind of bit here, bit there? How did that go?
Yeah. You know, The apple market, or the fruit market, has always been in the beginning the most important segment, and then of course as I love wine as well, and disease prediction at that time was already in that time in the early 90s, you called it expert system. It's not called disease support system as you call it now. It was called expert systems. So I was involved in the beginning of the 90s, and I took visited a very big conference or conferences. It was more a decision support research conference in New York at the Geneva University. It was in 92. And that was a working group on downy mildew prediction in viticulture. And downy mildew and apple scab, they have a very similar, biology, where you can, if you know what's going on in terms of leaf wetness, temperature, humidity, and rainfall, you can forecast the appearance or the development of the disease.
Okay.
And by that,
that's a different disease right there.
That's just the coffin which doesn't let me. But with that, you need to measure really in the field. And that's not only, let's say, for the diseases in apples, grapes, and strawberries. It's for all the diseases, as you know, when there is a certain microclimate conditions and the biology and the development of the crop or the phenology of the crop is ready to that, the disease will appear unless you interfere with the proper biological or chemistry into this cycle. No?
So when did things start getting kind of, you know, I mean, to your point, big problem solving big kind of issues. When did things really start taking off on that end of things?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't call it it took off already in a big way, because I'm a visionary, and a visionary needs to also to say, okay, when it's the time when it's really taking off. Is it 100,000 weather stations? Is it 1 million? Or is it 10 million weather stations in the field? No?
Sure.
And I'm now at the point where we have 100,000 in the field. But I think 100,000 is just a small dot in the world, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree.
Even though that we are one potentially one of the biggest in that market. But 100,000 is still, if you see how many millions of acres or hectares you have in the world, it's nothing. But I'm now going maybe in another history lesson about factors.
Well, okay, so we talked a little bit about that before we get there. You know, one thing, and we'll dive a little more on just kind of where things are on the whole Metto side and all that after the history lesson. But one thing I'm kind of I think just the curiosity of it is, so you're saying, okay, 100,000 is where you're at now. Do you think there's enough players doing weather stations, or there was more needed? Because I know in the last, like, I think like 10, you know, called the last 10 years, there's been a lot of other sensor groups doing little bits of weather here and there, you know, some in more simplistic ways, some in more complex ways, you know, and you see some of the main other groups out there. You're one of them. There's a few others, and the need with all the, you know, you could say from the climate change side, environmental, just of people wanting to know more of what they're measuring just from the weather front, in their own microclimate, as you said, can those goals be actually reached with kind of the current tech, or do we need, you know, to get to those million, 10 million that you'd like to get? Is kind of a newer piece of technology needed, or some newer things, or what do you think of all that?
Look, I think and you asked the question before about when everything took off. To a certain extent, I wouldn't say it took off dramatically, but it was with the onset of the internet and the Internet of Things.
Sure.
And if you look in, let's say, the smart magazines, the Internet of Things is a big trend, and is not a trend; it's a need. And in agriculture, I think we need that Internet of Things to be used more. But it was back in 2004 when we launched our first iMetos weather station, where there was no Internet of Things name invented for that yet. So we just talked about machine to machine. But in all my engineers, I had only four of them at that time. Said, you're crazy. You're nuts. That doesn't work, because we just had this beautiful Windows software, which was giving nice graphs at that time. Sure. You remember? And this internet in 2004 was really crappy. The graphs were not even close what you're seeing.
I can understand that 100%, because I would have some of the same arguments with my dad, because we created a internet mapping software before Google came out with Google Maps. And it's like, well, there's no internet in rural areas yet. That was kind of, we're like, oh, it's going to get there really fast. And, you know, it's seemingly kind of crazy, but I mean, to your point earlier, that's, you know, you need to think a little ahead and be visionary about it. So you can get to that scale earlier when you're ready. I think that's kind of an important part about it. Cause while in the moment, I think it's easy to, for many groups, especially in the tech side of ag and beyond, is to kind of keep doing what works and just keep doing that thing. But if you can't see forward, you can easily get, everyone talks about in business timing and luck and all that. You got to hit the right timing. Well, if you can't start thinking in the future about some of the visionary things that you want and be prepared for it, you're never going to catch the right timing moment because you're not ready.
Yeah.
And while there is some luck to it, you know, someone's like, I want, you know, for your aspect, oh, we want weather stations. We want 10,000 of them. You know, sometimes those things happen. If you're also not prepared to understand how to build 10,000 sensors, you might be, you know, shit out of luck.
Yes, absolutely. No. And that time, it was really sometimes, it was in many different, many aspects, very challenging, to get SIM cards, just to get SIM cards at that time was a nightmare. We had, let's say SIM cards, prepaid SIM cards sometimes, and also to get all the settings correct in the different countries. It was just like, it was, but when we figured this out, it took us probably about a year or so, to figure that out. And then, all of a sudden the beauty was we could do everything from the manage the stations from the remote. We could help the client to use the data. I tell you a story about Italy, no? Because my wife is from Italy and I love Italy. We drink a lot of Italian wines, but not only. A very big company called Fontirutoli. You can find it. Fontirutoli, a company who exists since 1600 in Tuscany, no? And if somebody wants to see a nice place, go to there. You see the castle and
that sounds two things on that. For one, I enjoy a good glass of wine. Italy is kind of a known place for that. So you need to invite me one of these days over. So and we'll go skiing. We'll do all those fun things. But yeah, some of I'm just popping the kind of the scene in my head of what you're talking about. But I'm also really curious if the transcribing feature on the podcast will spell that out correctly. Cause I know I would murder it myself if I tried to put
it in the show notes.
Sounds so good.
What happened? The guy called me hilarious in Italian. I speak also Italian. No, I said, look, the fucking stuff is not working. I said, okay. And, you said, supply me this weather station, it's not working. And I said, look, no problem. It's only 600 kilometers, which is in miles. It's even less. No, go there. And I drive there the same day. And I said, look, if it's my fault, no problem. If it's your fault, 10 bottles of your best wine goes into my direction.
that's a good trade.
and then I came there and I saw it because at that time it was no internet station. Mm-hmm. And I saw that the cable from the computer to the weather station, the lady from the cleaning disconnected it, no?
Oh, fun.
So that was a lesson. I say, okay, we need to have something which is remote. We can check it if there's...
Yep.
And so that's just one of the millions of stories which we had.
That reminds me of countless times when someone would use our thing and it's like, that's not working. And there's others in the industry all over the place that have dealt with this. You know, why isn't it working? Why can't I log in? And a first question, you wouldn't think to ask it, especially, but in the early days of the internet, you kind of had to, you know, open your browser and just type Google in or type Yahoo in or whatever, a website that you're accustomed to and see if it is on. And, you know, then it would pop around the screen, no internet. And like, well, know, there's your sign, I guess. I don't know what to tell you. Sorry, but yeah, no shortage of horror stories around tech maintenance and serviceability, to say the least.
You know, and with the new solutions of having this online, we took out lots of these variables, which the cleaning lady disconnects the cable of the computer, no, and the modem didn't work, no, because it was the modem dial-in didn't work, no, you know, this old time modems, no. So,
well, I'm guessing the wine tasted very good after that, and the wine as well.
I think I still have one of these bottles in my cellar.
So. Oh wow! Yeah, that'll be an extra sweet one when you maybe retire. The first glass out of that, be like, oh, this is just taste extra good. So so Godfrey, yeah, we're okay. So there's this history lesson you want to talk about?
To give you the story about. The tractor, and everybody knows the tractor is the most important, let's say, asset for most people in the farm. No?
Yep.
I'm reading the Economist for the last 45 years. So the Christmas edition of this year caught my attention. It was the story about the tractor in English. No, there's only 2 days, a 2-page article. And it reminds me very much on the uptake of let's say the internet of the precision farming or the ag tech, however you call it, nowadays. No, and at that time, you know, the tractor was in. I think I found it. The first tractor sold in U.S. was sold in 1892 to a guy by the name John Fröhlich, and you know, in Fröhlich is a German name. It means the happy one, no? John Fröhlich. So somebody made Mr. Fröhlich happy selling the first tractor, no? But you know, it took a while that the tractors really outnumbered the horses and the mules, no? I have here an interesting in this article. I can forward it to you if you want. In the mid, let's say, 1920s, you had something like 25 million horses in the U.S. And only about, let's say, maybe 10,000 tractors, something like that. And you would think, why didn't they get up? Because the farmers in the 20s, they had already cars, no? And they never used tractors, no?
Well, I know from like our farm where my great grandpa started, and it was late 1800s, and then he had six kids, so everyone was, you know, working on the farm. I mean, he had a steam engine. I can't remember what kind what it is, but we always go to the steam thresher show nearby, and there's always a guy has the same model, so we always take a picture by it every year, and kind of have seen ourselves grow around it. But he had a threshing machine too. And I mean, from that time frame, just the pictures and the stories that I've heard from my grandparents, I can see why it was less. I mean, because the steam engine was almost kind of, I mean, it was revolutionary, but you could only really have one of them. It was kind of the power plant to everything around there. So as how we think about it today. So but anyways, go on.
So basically, they came up. First of all, the tractor, the anti-tractor lobby in this camp was the Horse Growers Association of U.S. They said to farmers, "Don't buy a tractor because it brings you into unmanageable debts." No, so that's the first thing. So,
they said,
"Don't do that." No?
Tell that to horse owners now. They probably think quite the opposite. Horses will bring you into an unimaginable debt.
And then, of course, there were lots of, let's say, companies who are soliciting basically the tractor usage, no, in the 20s and so forth. And they send out letters and say, then, of course, a lot of the farmers said it's not that useful as it is supposed to be, no? Like a car, no? They used cars, but
the tractor was not.
And because mm-hmm. they had steel wheels and no power lift was there, so they could only do limited things, no? And then they got stuck in the mud, no? And then they need the horses again to take them out again.
So, good points. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, that's just I just go through a little bit of more. So and of course, and later on, the tractor was taken on more, and it was. First of all, the cost of the let's say the labor cost after the war took a big hit in the upper direction. Then, of course, John Deere invented the power lift, was the revolution there, and then of course you had also to have let's say sort of restructuring the farm for the tractor. No, now you have it in the way of the autonomous tractor now. No. But in this case, the farms were not suitable for the tractor usage, and of course the farms were not big enough for the tractor. No, especially I'm European. We at that time, and I told you that we had 10 hectares, we couldn't afford a tractor. No, so we had at that time we hired a contractor. No, to do some of the work. No, and that's why in Europe, because of the farms are much smaller. A lot of this called of machine and rings were developed where people had a big machinery and then they come and service you with baling and whatever or combining and so forth. No, so but that all together brings, let's say, also the same. It took basically until the 1970s. That there was a threshold of 5 million tractors in the U.S., and then the horses went down to, let's say, the big gap between tractors and horses were in, let's say, in the mid 50s. So there's the same amount of tractors and horses, and then now, of course, the horses are a leisurely thing, no?
Yeah, or dog food, you know, one or the other. But those, to that story, what a few pieces kind of come to mind with how it relates, because I mean that's kind of the point, is how it relates kind of to the ag tech side and precision ag side. And you mentioned you know, the tractors would get stuck in the mud and the horses would have to pull them out, and it kind of makes me think of, you know, some of the call it ag tech solutions out there now. Some of them are getting stuck in the mud. And really, to bail it out, you have some, you know, older methods to try to get you back on track. And but to the point, you know, it's still relatively early in a lot of this, the technology that's being played around, and you know, we see that everywhere pretty much. Some are, you know, some where it's a little easier in other areas, but you know, to the other part of the story. And from what I was talking about, my grandpa doing threshing, like he would do that. He got a steam engine and had a threshing unit, and he would do it for others, and, you know, drive around to the neighbors, and they would all kind of share into it. And I still see remnants of that today with some large farms. Of course, it's becoming so industrialized too. It's going to be interesting how the robotics play. And I, you know, I'll mention it and talk about it here and there. About, you know, some areas it's going to do, I think, great things. In other areas, it's going to be hard to integrate it into kind of the current culture of you know, just as much as horses were and tractors. It's going to happen. It's just, it's going to be quicker in other areas, you know, much like maybe the car replacing the horse. That happened earlier.
Yeah.
And that happened, you know, faster. Like I remember reading a story the other day about, I think it was either Chicago or New York. The reason why there's stairs and stoops going up to, you know, houses in, you know, like downtown New York is because the lanes, the roads were full with feet of manure that just was just sitting there. And so you needed stairs to rise above it. And that's a big reason why that exists. And, of course, people didn't like that and it smelled. So, you know,
yeah.
How robotics are going to play into that will be interesting.
I would say there's definitely that robotics is coming in some way or another. I was not at the Commodity Classic 2 weeks ago, but we had a booth there, and John Deere showed here this new massive behemoth stuff. Like I was going to call it S7 or what, with 900 horsepower or so, and this reminds me also
$1.388 million list price for it.
Yeah,
that's what I saw the other day. So you know, not. Yeah. Just a little bit.
Just and the question is here. Yeah, is this the way we should go? But that's not. I do not have the answer for it, and I don't want to have the answer for it. But mm-hmm. what I can with my little knowledge about agriculture and the technology uptake in agriculture. I think we need to bring, let's say, technology to make these huge machines more smarter. Because at the end of the day, farming happens outside, and we talk about weather, and weather is not under our control. Fortunately,
yeah. No?
Otherwise, you would have. I would have. If I'm golfing, I would like to have nice weather, don't rain. If I'm a farmer, I would like to have. But rain, no?
Well, yeah, I'll take rain. Where I get in trouble with golfing is the wind, because there's no trees around here and it's flat. So you can have the perfect straight, perfect drive, and then just the wind's like, nope, see you later. Here's it in the pond. So, but to that point, you know, I've been thinking about that too, the kind of the limit of size. But yet, you know, compared to where you're at a lot in Europe, I'm in the Northern Plains and close to Western Canada. I've dealt with a lot of people in Western Canada on the ag side. And honestly, it makes sense to have a tractor that big, because there's not a lot of people to help. So if you can, you know, instead of the 60-foot drill that you pulled, you can pull a 90-foot and get more done. And heck, it's got tools in it that can apparently drive itself here in the future. Or most of the people that are going to buy that don't buy one. They buy like five of them mm-hmm. up in some of the large farms in Canada that I know you've dealt with too.
Yeah, yes, sir.
And you know, it'll get to this kind of master slave relationship with these large tractors. Like, fill it up. Yes, the one is going, and the other one's just kind of following, because you're. Or I could see that, you know, in Brazil or in kind of, you know, the other larger farming areas of the world. So there's a fit, but yeah, does that work in Western Europe? No.
No, Western Europe is because we have such a high population in the farming areas. So and of course,
well, heck, you guys don't even put duals on your tractors, and that's like there's triples and duals here commonly. And I think to that point, when I've talked about, you know, getting back to the robotic side and some of the other tech, I think often we kind of forget. Sometimes, especially when these new press releases come out of this tech or that tech, that, you know, other areas of the world farm differently. The cultures of how you farm are different. There's other crops involved. And, you know, something like, yes, at Commodity Classic, you know, John Deere got a big, everybody spread it around like wildfire. Well, that equipment that they're releasing really is only meant for a finite group of people. I mean, probably, if you actually do the numbers, there's probably only 5,000 farms that would ever buy those things brand new because mm-hmm. of their size and scale. But that those 5,000 farms farm 50% of the production in US and Canada for small grains, for instance, or something like that. I know there was some new numbers that came from the USDA that kind of highlight that. But, you know, to the point of robotics, it's like, I mentioned this on a little video I have. I got a little John Deere 1025Rs, 25 horsepower tractor. Mm-hmm. Well, that can be turned more robotic, and that can work in vineyards or smaller farms to pull a 1-2 bottom plow or a mm-hmm. single planter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I see a lot of the robotics companies, you know, some of these startups that they'll make this little, their own little tractor. And I get why they do it, you know, 100%. Mm-hmm. And then but I see like mine sitting in my garage. I'm like, well, that could work. It just needs a steering column and a few sensors, you know, probably another, $10,000-$20,000 worth of tech versus the $20,000 it costs. And I think people kind of forget that the large OEMs have those things too. They can utilize those things. They're just haven't yet. And maybe it kind of even brings to the point of what you're doing from the weather side is there's a lot of things that you do, but some of those things just aren't utilized in the way that they can be quite yet as well. And there's just kind of like maybe there's a waiting game or something. Yeah, but
I would say, of course, the marketing power of companies like John Deere, CNH, Echo, whatever, this is huge. No? And of course, even in our segment, we don't want and we don't have that money that we can do things what in a launch of a product, no? Like a weather station, which we launched in 2004. Yeah, we just and that the social media was not existing at that time, more or less. Yeah. No? But of course, now we do a lot of, let's say, marketing, not only anymore in the magazine, in the printed magazine, but we just go and do it online with all the let's say the channels which are farmers using. No, it's Facebook, Instagram, or whatever. No.
Well, it's things like this, and I remember some of the early days too. Like the only way to get kind of the word out was go out to all the trade shows and travel a lot and put a thing in the big magazine, Successful Farming, Farm Journal, or whatever in that region. And I mean, for a single page or a quarter page, it's $1,000 or up to like $10,000-$15,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's you've seen the change in that. The magazines aren't as thick anymore. They're not as, they're not quite as popular because social media and other things have happened. And it's just kind of, I have to laugh about it because with some of the other, early founders in different parts of precision ag and ag tech that I grew up around from all aspects, I got to know some of these people going to all these shows, and now like people don't go to the shows as much anymore because it's so expensive. And you can create your own podcast like this and talk to a group and get a message out. And it's just changed the dynamic so much. But yet there's still a want to get out of the house and go visit people in person, hence why, they still exist.
Nathan, I fully agree on that, and of course, we know that we are let's say in a sort of relationship, an OEM relationship with John Deere, and we phased out one of their products, the weather products, in 2018. And because John Deere wanted to make sure that if they phase out the product, there is a replacement. And so we basically replaced about 2,000 John Deere weather stations. No? And that was 2018 to 2020. And 2020, the small bug hit the world. No? And all the work which we did at that time to educate John Deere dealers, what is the usefulness of weather information, real-time weather information, let's say basically evaporated, because they had to concentrate on the supply chain issues and then the core business. So they forgot about weather stations and so forth.
That kind of reminds me, because when I first got kind of more connected to you guys, I was working with Telus at the time, and they bought like down 200 or 300 stations, or it was from the Meto side. That happened right during COVID and all the rules came out, to stay at home. And I know that became a problem, just like legally, could you go help check and sell these things? And, government saying this, farmers want to do this and agronomists want to do that. And it created a problem. And it kind of, the whole program kind of a little bit fell apart. A lot of different reasons, not just COVID, but, and then I know my waning days from there, they threw that on me and they're like, try to, it's like people liked them. They wanted them. They liked what they were doing. But the serviceability of they were taking it on more, and I don't know, didn't have enough people, and things happen, shipping issues, this sensor doesn't fulfilled, not for, I mean, because of just outside issues. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just created a kind of little weird situation, but it helped me learn a lot about what you guys were doing for sure. And kind of the whole process. And I will say this, it definitely enlightened me. I was never really a weather station guy. I just didn't really thought about it much, even though I fully, you know, had no problem with it whatsoever. So that was a good experience, but, you know, maybe shifting gears a little bit that, cause you know, I want to bring up, you know, we talked about, you know, history, story, little things here and there. Talking a little bit more about what you guys are doing now, like what are you helping with? What are the things you're changing, making better? Cause you are in a kind of a unique space, and I'll call it this, from the ag tech perspective, you're selling a piece of hardware, but you actually have the software side too, mm-hmm. which is rare, but it's also really hard to do that, to tie the two. But people like their physical things when they pay, you know, $3,000-$5,000 for a weather station, whatever it is, they have it. They like to hold it. And so you have that advantage, but then you got to get them to, you know, from farmers and agronomists to actually use the data that's coming off of it for something beyond trivial weather decisions that inherently we're used to. So maybe talk a little bit more about, you know, the Mentos side, where things are now, and maybe how you're handling some of those kind of hardware software challenges that exist.
Yeah, look, as I'm a banker, I'm a very cautious person on money, no? So I was very careful in the spending money on, let's say, on basically useless things to make too much, let's say, noise about us. Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, we are a company who is basically family owned with a little bit of private equity in it. But basically, it's a family business. We are now roughly around 180 people globally. We built with the team now, we built, let's say, a network of own companies in the most important markets, now like the U.S., Canada. We've now, let's say, a team which is basically owned. They are all owned by Mentos Pestle Instruments, Canada, U.S., Mexico, Brazil, Australia, then South Africa, and then of course the European market, which is very much fragmented. Mm-hmm. So we own about 15 affiliates, and that allows us to be very close to the client. We don't want to sell to the end user, but we want to be close to our partners, because at the end of the day, we know that the IoT will break, but we don't know when. So
100%.
we need to make sure we have a program in place where the device is always working. And of course, with the help of our platform Field Climate, we know so much about it, so we can have predictive mm-hmm. maintenance and all the things which is built in, which has been built up in the last 20 years since we have that platform. So that allows us to be some sort of unique in this space. And I have clients, they use even the first serial number. They're still using that device. Not the same device hardware-wise, but the same serial number, because mm-hmm. be careful, because where the information gets more and more valid, the longer I have the same set in my farm. If I'm a wine grower mm-hmm. and I have 20 years of weather data of my particular fields or my vineyard, this is an asset. And even for a farmer in your space in North Dakota, if I want to rent my land and I have 5 years of data or 10 years of data of that land, it becomes more.
I couldn't agree with that more. And I hear some farmers and different service providers talk about it that way. And that's one thing I've always pushed. And I was actually on a different podcast last week with someone from New Zealand talking about this. And it, you know, adoption in general is fairly low in certain parts of ag tech for sure. Gaining in others, but that's always been kind of my argument with when some people say, well, I don't need this. I can do it this way. I'd be like, guys, just grab the data, whether you do anything with it, but just get it, make some notes about it, do something, you know, small with it, but have it, because you're going to be surprised how much that is worth to you in the future. You know, okay, you got to, you know, yield data from in your combine, from your monitor, take it out and clean it and then set it away if you want. But do that, because you're never going to do it in the future if you got to clean the data, that stuff, you got to kind of do a little bit with it. And certain other parts, even on the imagery side, it's like, grab the image, put some notes to it, put it in a folder, put it in your drawer, who cares? But have it so that you can reference it back to that time when, you know, it didn't rain in June, but it rained a ton in July and you need to do this or that. And, you know, it comes in with the weather side. You know, it's one thing understanding sort of what temperature it was in the broad area or sort of how much it rained in the broad region that you live in. But as we talked earlier, the microclimates, the smaller things.
Yeah.
There's a lot more change field to field and area to area than most people really think about. And I mean, honestly, you know, this would be your goal of getting millions and tens of millions out. Every field should have some sort of weather station in it.
That's why, exactly. And of course, we are by far not there. But we're talking not about the farm weather station. The next generation, next gen product we already are having in the market is just a simple rain gauge and a temperature and humidity sensor. And this is in the range of, if you want to have it rented, it's not more than $250 per year. So then you say, okay, do I need to divide it by 1,000 acres or 500 acres? But then you make the division and say, okay, how much is this data costing me per year? And
well, just, I mean, I think about that. So if 250 per, you know, I think on a, call it average size field, call it $2 an acre, you know, the decisions people make based on weather from just an app right now of when to spray or when to combine or when to whatever. And it's still kind of a guessing game to a point. You know, that's cheap insurance. That's really cheap insurance. Just a simple gauge that does a rain amount and temperature humidity. Cause that's 90%, you know, what people are interested in the first place. The other stuff is great.
I want some soil temperature, because in your place, soil temperature is a very important parameter to start your planters and all the things in the spring and so forth. But that's already luxury. But I would say, that's why I said 20 million, 100 million potential rain gauges in the field. And you have these rain gauges from the big multinational chemical companies. They give you rain gauges and you put your rain gauge out there in your fields. But the problem is the farms are getting bigger. Farmers want to have this information right in the way on the operation center of John Deere or wherever, or on your app, and say, okay, now this field has received half an inch of rain. The other field has received a quarter inch. The next field received 2 inches, no? And and then the big machinery, every decision costs me hundreds of dollars per hour, I guess, no?
Well, you think if someone's, you know, if John Deere knows their numbers and others that, you know, CNH, AGCO, whomever, all equipment's, you know, gaining price. And I mean, from what used to cost a few hundred thousand dollars is now, you know, north of a million. You'd think to get the best use out of those things and when to put them in a field, having a little weather station for a few hundred bucks would probably be a pretty smart investment, when just idling a machine that costs $1 million costs you $50 an hour just for it to idle.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Whatever it comes down to. It's,
that's yeah. why that's why I was playing this history game here, because at the end of the day, it needs to be making click in the head of the farmer. I say, I need 100 rain gauges on my farm, and they are all connected. And yeah. if I join these rain gauges with my neighbor farmer, I can do that because the rain doesn't stop at the border of that one farm. So I can team up with my three colleagues and put in 1,000, for example, on an area.
I have an unfortunate story that sometimes the weather does stop at the field boundary of the neighbor.
Really? Why?
Oh yeah, just a quick thing because it deals with weather and it's a great segment part too. But first year I farmed, so that was I didn't farm a lot, but a little bit, a little over 100 acres. I think it was 2005. I put in corn. No one put in corn in our area at the time. It's a perfect year for it. It was great. I even side dressed it via cheap cultivator and anhydrous system that I set up, which you know, and that helped too. But I didn't put on hail insurance, and guess what happened? This little cloud, I was watching it over a little on the internet as it came over because my neighbor said, oh, I got a little bit of hail. You should check. And it was just a slow moving cloud. Mm-hmm. And the main field I was farming, there was two fields at the time. It literally missed the field next to it. It mm-hmm. doused. It sat over my field for 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it just hailed.
Destroyed it.
It just cut down to the roots. And then it started to wane off. So then my uncle was farming the quarter next to me. His got a little bit. Then it slowly kind of went to my other field. Not to the other fields north and south. Started at the one field that I was doing. And then a mile down the road, hit the other one and damaged that like 50%. And, you know, I didn't have hail insurance, so I had a general multi-peril coverage, which covered the costs.
Yeah.
But, that's a learning lesson. So I will say, at times, weather does stop at one border.
Yeah, absolutely. No,
look. But, yeah, to your point, it doesn't usually. So having neighbor data is important.
And that's why we see more and more farmers, they team up and they just say, okay, I have 5 weather stations, 10 weather stations, whatever, and you have 5, and then we just exchange the data. We can easily do that, and then they got their own personal network of weather information, and when they and normally we tell to the guys, leave this station, they're out all the year round because also the winter information is important, no? And
well, they can kind of create their own little. In a sense, you can create your own little data co-op of sorts too. And I would think, you know, especially for smaller farms that are, you know, finding it maybe hard to compete with larger farms, even if you can tie some of that type of stuff together, you know, in some sense, depending on the crop, especially in the type of farm it is, you know, that might give you some more leverage in selling, you know, maybe as a little local co-op of farms coming together, that might help you sell your product easier than say the huge large farm next to it or whatever, because you have some more unique data. And, you know, to your point earlier is leave that thing out there, leave it out for, you know, from when you bought it, just leave it there forever. As long as it, you know, maintain it as needed.
Clean it once in a while. And that's it. And
set it. You're the set it and forget it. You're the Ron Popeil of weather or of sensors, and set it and forget it.
Absolutely. No, but just this, we talked about the weather, the importance of rain gauges and temperature and humidity. But of course, we're talking about in the future, there is, and we are very successful, as you know, in Canada with soil moisture monitoring. Mm-hmm. And soil moisture monitoring, even in non-irrigated crops, is a very important, let's say, a data set, because yes. I know when the plant is running out of water. So having a sensor of the profile and the up, down to, let's say, 2-3 feet, I can understand where my root zone is, and if there is enough water that the plant can grow and produce. And if there is no water, you can put as much fertilizer as you wish. It will end up in the.
Well, and to that point up here, you know, a lot of guys will say fertilize in the fall, say with anhydrous, or you know, it's getting less and less, but nitrogen doesn't move when it's 55 degrees and less. Yeah. So if you know that, and people will put in corn seed, you know, wheat, whatever, when the ground is below that, even though it's not recommended because of timing, and that happens in Canada too, is to get it in, and with some of the seed treatments, you can kind of get by with going in a little colder. But if you can understand the timing of that a lot better, you can just manage your nutrient uptake you can time it better in a more unique way instead of just kind of guessing. And then of course, to the other point, you know, and I've dealt with plenty of variable rate, this and that, if you can understand the dynamics of those different areas better, well, you know, there's new methods where you can change the seed depth on the go. Clearly changing seeding amounts and fertility amounts on the go has, you know, been around for a long time, but you can fine tune it a little better than just say with the normal maybe map you've been used that's based off say elevation imagery, yield data, whatever. It doesn't matter. Sometimes that there's that other core element that's needed that I think some people it's easier for them to forget about it because people are so used to kind of the commoditization of weather data that, oh, I see it on the local news. It's 55 degrees here, or they see it on an app right now. You know, everyone's got some weather app, and you kind of just get used to the broadness of what it's telling you and you forget to fine tune it. And I find that a big problem on the remote sensing side, especially with like satellite imagery. So many have, you know, used in a feed from say a government satellite. I mean, I'd use that all the time. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's become kind of, oh, it's there, here it is, that's good enough. When actually it's not good enough when you're making these hard decisions, spending hundreds of dollars an acre or hectare or whatever, and you're paying for equipment, the prices they are, and for the insurance, the inputs, all this, and you're relying too much on the commoditized side of weather data and not the more intense side that you need from infield sensors or things like that, or diving into the data further, even if it is open free data, there's, you know, you guys do modeling and other stuff with even that data to match it with your weather stations to kind of create a cohesive answer. And you have those, I know you have different levels of, you know, what people can get, you know, from the simplest modeling techniques to, you know, the sensor, the cheaper one you're talking the field to, you know, $5,000 sensor sitting in the field. And that's a challenge, I think, you know, the general industry has, is trying to get away from the simple data pieces that almost seem, you know, they're free and they just feel free. So the value of them seems worthless in a sense because they are free. So to that point, because I know you guys clearly deal with it, a lot of other people in ag tech deal with it. And it's some of the reasons why there's maybe some issues is on the adoption side and call it others, just, you know, getting sales of their sensors. From your experience, because you've been fighting through that for decades, mm-hmm. How do others get past that to say, you got to dig deeper on this stuff. You got to get these sensors. You got to go further to really do it.
Yeah. I thought about many years about this. And you see this, let's say the startup mentality. No, you come in with something that say I have the best weather station in the world, and this stuff, this, and the communication is the best, and it works out of the ground. They forgot, I was reading a book over Christmas from Elon Musk, and it was very educational for me. Even I have my concerns about the person, but that's a different story. But what he said in that book is very true. You can change all rules in the world, no? Because that politicians and whatever done, but you cannot change the physics. And sometimes some of the startups try to change physics. And my wife says, look, because we were investing in a few startups, and in one startup I invested, after 3 weeks I pulled out. So. But I'm very fast in that.
You've gone through enough knowledge. If in a sense, from what you've known, if you can't understand what it is and what it's not in 3 weeks, you probably shouldn't. You should have your decision in that once you feel it.
Yeah. And I did two startup investments, and both of them I left. And from that moment, I said, no, I'm not going into startup investment anymore. But I invested in a few, let's say, rotten or stranded assets, no? Mm-hmm. And one of that product, which I think is because we talked about weather and the importance of nutrition when you put the right amount of fertilizer into the ground and or on the leaf and whatever, is monitoring what is the nutritional status of the plant. And also here we paid a lot of money, but it was my own money, and it was some European grant money which we were burning. And at the end of the day, one of the products could not make it. We did a lot of things, and the market didn't accept it. But one of the stranded asset, which was also coming from a French university, and this product is fantastic. I can measure immediately the nutritional content of any plant just going there. Plant take a leaf. They'll go there without detaching the leaf. Measure the nitrogen balance index, and it gives me immediately information. Combined, you are an expert in satellite images, combined with other data. And that's why I said important is here not that you are the best in the best of that segment, but you need to collaborate. You need to bring together other technologies. And then we need the input companies. We need the machinery companies. We need the seed companies. We need the precision ag companies. We need the satellite guys. We need the weather forecast people. We need insurance people, the example which you had with your – so.
Well, in that situation, it would have been nice that all of us neighbors would have had local weather stations, and I would at least got a little bit coverage right before it came automatically. Just give me, $50 of coverage versus, the $200 that I probably should have put on, just a little bit.
Yeah. No, but that's how I wanted to say is all this ag tech and this precision ag is a massive change in the mindset of people. So nobody in the world can control it. And we are going now into generative AI and all the things. Guys, be very careful what's going on in the future. No?
I've used some cool tools around it. And then I see other people playing with it in ag, and of course there's a lot too that have said, oh, we're AI analytics this, and they're not. They're people in the back house doing stuff. Some are doing real stuff, and then there's kind of a medium ground. But no, it's there's so much that we could do more with all of this, and it all seems. I know a talk I had with another person recently. They're like, well, why? We can prove that this helps, this data here, this data there, adding all the things like you just said, we can prove that it helps you, but they won't do it. And I think it comes down to a point earlier though, with what you're doing, trying to do on the, the smaller weather stations, is making kind of a local network, with your neighbors. Mm-hmm. I think that's an approach that clearly some agronomists have done it in their own ways. And you could say some smaller retailers or stuff have done it in certain ways, but one of the things, the relationship side of ag is so important, especially locally. And maybe that's how we all kind of kick off adoption a little more, is like, finding these little regional groups of farmers that instead of trying to sell to one farmer, sell to him and his best neighbor friends around him as a group. So like, hey, as a group, buy these here. It's a little better deal overall. And then you all kind of force yourself to use it because you are all collaborating. Because one of the issues I've found is a lot of times they don't know what questions to ask because they want to use it. They just don't know what questions to ask. And then they become frustrated easily. And even I see that with service providers with all this data. And it's, if we use kind of more of that maybe community method of collaborating, you know, to your point, it's like, okay, we're coming together. We're going to pick the weather group that we want to work with, you know, call it Mesos. We're yep. going to work with this software that can bring in these other data sets. Okay. Cause it works with all of our different machinery and they all kind of work together on it in kind of that, you know, even back to the conversation on tractors is, you know, people would share one tractor between multiple farms to get going. And yeah. in time, they bought their own tractor and created their own thing, but they didn't start that way. Even on the animal side, a lot of times animals were, you know, shared through neighbors and how they were doing it to farm and other services. The whole co-op method with elevator, grain elevators and stuff that is huge where I live is still strong because of some of that idealism of working together. And we've kind of forgot about it. Maybe there's been too much individualism in agriculture and we need to get all this ag tech stuff going in the way that we all know it can. We have to almost kind of bring up the older methods to compare to what we know, to your point with from the animal, the tractor side, how tractors came to be and, mm-hmm. and follow that guide. Something like no, that.
I think you had the guest, which is Mr. Rob Sake. You had him in the previous podcast. And I know Rob for the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I visited him about 2 months ago or 1 month ago in his summer residence in Arizona. We had a good chat and a few beers. And he has this data-driven approach with his software, and I think he was very successful at the time with this AgriTrend, and of course the big companies. He sold his company to this to Trimble, and of course they had some other different strategies. Anyway, but we see this data-driven decision making, but again with hard facts undermined, not. With some shaky data from an app, which you don't know the data source. Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, I need to know what is the rainfall. How can I go on that field with that tire pressure? Or when can yeah. I go with this in this field? And because my production land is my factory, no?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
if I destroy it, then we see that... maybe you get go to the bank and ask for additional credits, no? So
it gets more complicated the less you are aware,
yep.
of what you're doing in your field. And I mean, I see that you can see it flying around, and you know, there's talk about, you know, that big new tractor John Deere came up with. Of course, Case came up with a big one, same size, basically. It's just no one cared because it wasn't green at the show. Yep. And they're heavy, and I've seen more and more compaction everywhere, and it's because people force it in. And you know, understanding, you know, that other element of, you know, temperature, moisture levels can at least make you. It might take a day difference, but that day difference and when you do it versus forcing it in can be a 10% yield difference throughout the field easily. Without question.
And what you said before about the analytics, if I have my yield maps and I have all this information about the variable rate application, if I have my weather data overlaying that file and I can compare last year with this year or the year 5 years ago, that gives me additional, let's say, confidence that this data is right. No, because sometimes you might have it even a wrong calibrated yield monitor. No, so.
Well, with like imagery, I've found that the people that use it best, what they do is they use it to go find what they remember or they have data on from the past. They don't use it necessarily in the in-season approach. There's certain applications that works fine for that, but a lot of the times you almost make it too complicated and the timing of everything is too complex. So what some will do, you know, they, for different years, they'll use a different year of image that matches what they're seeing in the current year. So say it's a little drier in June. Well, I'm going to go back to a year where I have data on that said it was drier in June. Oh, and it's the same crop, or it's a very similar type crop. And I'm trying to use that as a reference point, and to the point of, you know, using older data, getting recording that. I've seen more people have success using data in that sense, at least at the very basics, to get to the more advanced side of it, where maybe you are making those in-season decisions. But if we don't kind of look at the past either and what was grown and how it was grown, whether it was good or bad, doesn't even matter. Mm-hmm. It's hard to really know what you're going to be dealing with. And then it becomes a gambling guessing game where your risk is higher. And, you know, for instance, like in 2012, big drought across the entire Corn Belt. Mm-hmm. Some of the best data I've ever seen for how a field reacts to moisture throughout the entire Corn Belt was from 2012. And I tried to sell it night and day, but like, you should just always have this on hand. Always do mm-hmm. all your fields, get them all done and just save it and always have that for a reference. And people are just like, oh, I forgot about it. You know, this took care of the insurance, took care of this part or whatever. And I'm like, it's so valuable, some of that stuff. And, yeah. But it's old, it, you know, that's 12 years old now, and which is crazy to think of.
But as I said before, in-field weather data from your own farm or from your rented fields or wherever, it becomes so valuable because it's not anymore on your computer. That comes back to the other story about when it was on your own computer, but now it's in the cloud. And this data, as you can download the data, you can API the data into another software, and then do your own predictive analytics or your own data mining, and come up with a decision or with a know-how that you didn't have before when you didn't have the data.
A great example, and I should do it, although he probably doesn't really like me, is the guy that used to rent my wife's family's land where I used to live. They collected a lot of data, and I was like, God, I should just offer him like some money for that, because I don't know what they're doing with it now. Probably wouldn't sell it to me anyways, but mm-hmm. you know, say I ever got into farming it at some point. I mean, I don't care if it's 5 years old or 20 years old. I want to see that. Like I think you need to see it, and it's worth that conversation. And I think people need to think more. They think maybe with ag tech, they need to think more in terms of what the past can show them and what it kind of can build towards. So clearly, you know, I think we've thrown out a couple of life lessons of technology and ag so far. Yeah. And we're getting up in the time, but for one, so great conversation so far. Clearly, I think we could continue for hours on this, and we'll have to do a part two at some point, or some sort of follow up once you reach 200,000 weather stations or something out there. Yeah, hopefully, absolutely. It happens a lot faster than the build up to it.
That's not too far apart, because I was traveling this last year two times with our prime minister from Austria, and one was the first trip the Austrian prime minister did in Africa, and we visited Angola, Ghana, and Egypt.
Sure.
And I'm going to do a project in Africa and deploy 100,000 weather stations there. These are owned by Pestle Instruments or by the company I create there. And then we have data which Africa needs.
Yo, 100% way ahead of you there. I think it's a bigger question in general, but Africa's got so much arable land that can turn into, and they got people too. It's kind of, it's political, it's geopolitical and stuff, but it's enormous. If you add all the countries, like continents together, it's huge. It's bigger than.
Because in this trip we were on let's say on a hired plane, and we were 25 hours in the plane only, just from Austria to Angola, and Angola was not in the top of the and of course you have a lot of private time with your prime minister. And also the agriculture minister was there. So we said, look, we need to do that. And we need, and there is, and I wrote after that a small white paper for him, because he was meeting Mrs. Meloni, from the prime minister from Italy. And at the end of the day, she was presenting my paper at one of the.
look at the yarns you sew in this agricultural world.
At the end of the day, we didn't do it yet, but I take you at your word. When we have the 100,000 installed in Africa, which may be in a year and a half, more or less, then we can speak again.
That or sooner or whatever. We'll figure it out. I guess, before we end here, any kind of last general thoughts about, what you think of AgTech now, future, anything else? Just kind of a last little segment, if you want to call out anything or whatnot, Gottfried.
No, look, I think AgTech is coming. It's just got too much money on the venture side was thrown out for technology which's been
semi-ready,
solving problems which are very minor or not existing problems. Too many greedy investors. If you could spell IoT, you got already a million on your bank account. So be a little bit cynical.
AI, IoT, future, AI. ML, advanced,
machine learning,
analytics.
No, but look, at end of the day, we all need this technology because the margins are getting tighter. It's super stupid from people. The technology is out there. It's getting cheaper. One important thing is, which we didn't have in the past, of course, is the communication is going to be as good in the farming. And of course, John Deere now with the new satellite
Starlink.
Starlink connectivity. We use Starlink already in Brazil. So we have already. So I think we hope that we got very important and very, let's say, honest and well financed competitors. So we can bring the whole industry up the next steps, and so that we sell 20 million, the competitor sells 20 million, and we're all happy, no?
Well, to that point, there's clearly a lot of competition in the ag side, but on the tech side, adoption's still fairly low. There's plenty to get. There's plenty to grasp in this world on the tech side. There is no, we're not running out of potential customers. We're getting a little stuck in the mud, like that new tractor with the steel wheels was, and now maybe us old horses need to help pull those guys out a little bit, and get it going on the right path. I guess if that's an interesting way to transition out.
If I can find a few more interesting stranded assets, we will build into our ecosystem, and we are, as I said in the beginning, we are a very collaborative company because being a European, we have a little bit of a different perspective because we speak various languages, not only English, we speak German, we speak Italian. In my company, I have 17 nations, just to give you an idea. We have Africans, we have Kenya, we are from Kenya, we have Ukrainians. So it's a very important ecosystem, that helps to understand problems of the world. And yeah, we don't solve the problems tonight or today. So,
well, you know, there's a few stranded assets I think out there coming shortly. So you might get your bag fulfilled there. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. But anyways, it's been great talking about this and having you on the podcast. And I know for sure people will enjoy it. So like I said, thanks for being here. And I know we'll probably see each other fairly soon, and we'll have more to talk about, but over maybe a few beers or something, you know.
Oh, wine. Wine or beer.
Bring that special bottle of wine you've been saving since since your little service call in Italy.
You have to come to Austria because we are celebrating 40 years in June 6th. So I would send you an invite, actually.
I would like to get out to that area. My wife's lineage comes from, you know, German, so she's always wanted to visit that area. And I've heard the scenery. I've been to Germany twice, but the scenery in Austria is something to behold in parts of it. So absolutely. Until then, but once again, thanks for being on my third episode of Ag Uncensored podcast, and we'll get you again here once you reach that next big milestone and continue.
Thanks a lot, Nathan, and it was great to be in your podcast, and good luck for the future.
Well, thank you, and same to you. I'll end it there, and thanks everyone for listening, and as always, subscribe, follow, share, like all the social media parts, as everybody else says in podcastdom, if you want to call it that, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.